from the George Ignatieff Theatre at the University of Toronto, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation presents the 1989 Massey Lectures by Ursula Franklin. Her talks are being broadcast each night this week on Ideas and are called The Real World of Technology. Dr. Franklin is an experimental physicist, professor emeritus of metallurgy at the University of Toronto, and the only woman there ever to have held the title University Professor. She's a former board member of the National Research Council and the Science Council of Canada. She's a fellow of the Royal Society and an officer of the Order of Canada. In these Massey lectures, Dr. Franklin is discussing technology not as gadgets, but rather as a whole set of social and cultural arrangements characterized by production-based rules for social control, by pervasive mechanization, by mass production with rigid divisions of labor, and by an associated political mindset, all bundled together into a single social system. Her focus is on what it means to live in this real world of technology. Ursula Franklin.
Good evening, and thank you for coming. I looked at the weather and I was quite clear that I would never go out to anybody's lecture on a night like this. So I really feel very moved because I consider that a gesture of friendship, but also I hope I can consider it also as your willingness to be part of that ongoing discussion. I said a number of times that the problems that we need to address are not the sort of thing that one person can even begin to produce a solution. All I can do is an exercise of mapping, an exercise of trying to help in the process of clarification from which a very much larger and broader and more collective approach will come. And I see your presence as a justification for this mapping process, knowing that I'm not alone as I'm looking for a way through the dilemmas of a time that certainly is not a simple or a transparent time. And now I'd like to focus for a moment on the human consequences, which are particularly evident in what is called the communications technology, and I very often would like to call the non-communications technology, because very often I think that word communication technology is a misnomer. What I want to point out is that when human activities incorporate machines or rigidly prescribed procedure, the modes of human interaction change. In general, technical arrangements reduce or eliminate reciprocity. And what I call reciprocity is some manner of interactive give and take, a genuine communication among interacting parties. For example, a face-to-face discussion or transaction between people needs to be started, it needs to be carried out and terminated, all with a certain amount of reciprocity. Once technical devices are interposed, they allow a physical distance between the party, the reciprocity is distorted, it can be reduced, it can be eliminated. I'm very fond of a Ben Wicks cartoon, which illustrates that beautifully. That cartoon illustrates a television repairman in a living room removing a television set that has a very dramatically broken front. And next to the set stands a man on crutches with one foot heavily bandaged. And the repairman says to the man on crutches, "Next time Trudeau speaks, just turn the set off. And I think that says it all, because it says that a personal response of the kind that the man in the cartoon was obviously anxious to give could be neither given nor could it be received. The reciprocity was ruled out by design. And this loss of reciprocity is a continuing form of technologically executed inequality. And it has very profound political and psychological consequences. I'd like to stress here that reciprocity is not feedback. Feedback is a particular technique of systems adjustment. It is designed to improve specific performances. And the performance need not to be mechanical or carried out by a device, but the purpose of feedback is to make the thing work. And so feedback normally exists within a given design. It can improve the performance, but it cannot alter the design. Reciprocity, on the other hand, is situationally based. It's a response to a given situation. It is neither designed into the system nor is it predictable. And reciprocal responses may alter the initial assumptions. They can lead to negotiations. They can lead to give and take, adjustment, and bring new and unforeseen things. But technologies can be frequently designed in such a manner that there is no room for reciprocity. There is no place for response. And I want to quickly touch on what I see to be two consequences of that. If viewers are not called to respond, it gives me an explanation somehow why violence is not much more objected to when it's depicted on television. I cannot imagine a person being directly a witness to violence and not feeling either they have to intervene or even guilty for not intervening. But violence, when depicted in a situation that rules out reciprocity, suddenly becomes acceptable, enjoyable, however gruesome and demeaning the violence can be. And I think we have to think what that built-in absence of reciprocity does, because I feel it's a very important social parameter. These technologies that eliminate reciprocity also diminish the sense of our common humanity. This may sound melodramatic to you, but it can start with very simple things. Where there is no reciprocity, there's no need for listening. Then there is no need to understand or to accommodate. We hear from women who work within automated offices how much human isolation the automation has brought for them. Because when work isn't shared, the tools of cooperation, the listening, the adjusting, all this atrophies like muscles that are not in use. I had spoken in the first of these lectures about prescriptive technologies, and I had tried to stress that those are not just technical innovations, but social innovations, and that those prescriptive technologies are indeed a seedbed for a culture of compliance, and that because they require control and management and planning, Their presence, beginning at the workplace, begins to acculturate a society to accept planning, external control, and fragmentation of work as given and normal. Tonight, I want to come back to the prescriptive technologies, and I want to discuss the impact of technology on governance, on power, and on control. And I want to go back to the French social historian Michel Foucault and show that it was, in fact, in the 18th century, well before the machine age, that the very formative patterns were laid down, that the Industrial Revolution picked them up, and that we built on them. And you may say, why do I go back into so much history when I keep on saying the world has so fundamentally changed? And there is a certain contradiction that on the one hand I say how much the world has changed, and then I go back and say, look at France in 1750. The reason for doing that is that patterns have very deep and profound roots, and it is my conviction that we are coming to the end of a historical period in which processes and approaches that initially have been exceedingly constructive and helpful have run a course by which they now become in many ways counterproductive. And as we have to deal with what will be a very deep change of patterns, we need to know the origin and the purpose of the current patterns, and that we understand best from the historical development. To me, the patterns in the 18th century were the basic foundations for the Industrial Revolution. In turn, the Industrial Revolution provided a mindset as well as physical things that allowed the current development to take place without essentially a profound break. And we talk both about structures of the mind, structures of knowledge, of human and social relations, but I also want to talk about physical and administrative infrastructures as they were in the Industrial Revolution and expand into things today. And the reason for doing that is that more and more decisions are made in a technological mode, which is very difficult to influence through a democratic and egalitarian decision making. And we will be faced again in a number of guises with that question of democratic decision making on technical and technological matters. The real world of technology, as I've said so many times, is a very complex system. And nothing that I say and none of the highlights that I point to should give you an idea that I interpret what I see as technological determinants or any belief in the autonomy of technology per se. What one needs to emphasize, and I try to do that, is that technologies are developed and used in a particular social and economic and political context. They arise out of a certain social and economic and political situation. They are grafted on something. They may enforce or stifle those institutions in ways that are not always foreseen or even foreseeable. The change in one facet of technology, for instance, the introduction of computers somewhere in the workplace, changes all facets of technology. And that, of course, is the nature of systems. And people think more and more in terms of technological systems. Now, I personally prefer not to think in the abstract notion of systems as much as thinking in the notion of a web of interactions that allows me to see how the stress on one thread can change the tension on all other threads. But it also gives me the clear idea of the strength of a web, and it allows me to visualize patterns and designs. Anyone who has ever knitted or woven knows that one can change patterns, but one can change it only at certain places and in certain manners if one doesn't want to risk the continuity of the whole fabric. And when women like Barbara Deming speak and write about reweaving the web of life, then they mean exactly that. And they know that, first of all, there are other patterns. And I've emphasized throughout, and I want to emphasize again, that the patterns of technology are not fixed. But if we talk about pattern changes, then we first of all have to be very clear about the patterns that are there, what are their structures, what are their roots. And for that reason, I like to turn to these patterns and to the notion of planning, because these things don't just happen. Prescriptive technologies require planning. One has to assume that in every society, social institutions are designed and promoted so that the structuring authority gains an enhanced power. No ruling class plans for their own demise. So one can assume that the structures that are put into place are structures that enhance the existing powers. And the prescriptive technologies are very good devices for that, because the structuring is done at the workplace. It is a process of work that is a form of training for compliance that I think in many cases has been overlooked as providing the social soil that makes certain things acceptable, as I had shown earlier in a Chinese example. Foucault, the great French social historian who died about 5 years ago, wrote a number of very instructive books. I'm referring here to his book, Discipline and Punish, which looks at 17th century France and the structure of French schools, hospitals, military institutions, prisons, at the beginning of the 18th century, where a new notion enters the secular sphere, the notion of discipline. Discipline was a very well-developed notion in the monastic communities, but now it is being applied in great detail to the secular sphere, bringing refined hierarchical structures, rank and sub-rank, drill, surveillance, and an awful lot of record-keeping. In that period, a very influential book appeared. It was in 1740 that Le Maître wrote a book called L'Homme Machine, Man the Machine. And in it, there was a very detailed analysis of the human body, looked upon as an intricate machine, a machine that could be understood, controlled, and used. And Foucault points out that the discovery of the human body as a machine and as an instrument of power led to a host of regimes for the efficient operation of these machines, be they the efficiency of the physical movement, the measured intervals of the organization of physical activity, the careful analysis or timing of the tasks that a body could perform, and a group of bodies could perform, usually in unison. And Foucault reminded us that in the course of the 17th and 18th century, the disciplines of exercise, of training, of work, became the general prescriptions of dominance. And I'd like to quote one passage, one short paragraph from Foucault, where he says, "The human body was entering a machinery of power that explored it, broke it down, and rearranged it. A political anatomy was being born. It defined how one may have hold over another's body, not only so that they may do what one wishes, but so that they may operate as one wishes, with the techniques, the speed, the efficiency that one determined." So much for Foucault himself. But the prescriptive arrangement of human activity resulted in schools where the tasks of the pupils were timed down to the minute. They also resulted in the analysis of the movement of soldiers. For instance, in 1743, regulations were published specifying that there are 6 steps to bring a weapon to the soldier's foot, 4 to extend it, 13 to raise it to the shoulder, and so on. The drill based on these movements and steps made a military unit into a machine at the command of its superior. And in the same manner, the great workshops, particularly the great textile workshops of France, prior to the Industrial Revolution, already had a detailed labor discipline that corresponded quite closely to that of the army, the prison, and the school. And it was into this socially and politically well-prepared soil that the seeds of the Industrial Revolution fell. Now machines enter the picture. And the factory system, with mechanical devices and machines, extended and augmented the patterns of control that were put down 100 years before. The machinery didn't create them, the machinery enforced them. But the machines, with their minute description in detail, and the divisions of labor that they enforced, with the breakdown of processes into small prescriptive steps, were the outcome of that development. And that development then extended very quickly into non-mechanical applications, commercial, administrative, political, both in France and in England, where these innovations changed banking as much as schooling and prison, and it were exercises of control. And these required planning. And to plan with and for technology became the Industrial Revolution's strongest dream. A totally automated factory, a workplace completely without workers, was discussed in real terms already by Babbage and his contemporaries in the early 19th century. Until the end of the 18th century, the control and dominance was exercised by regarding human bodies as machines. In the 19th century, the machines alone could be visualized as instruments of control. And so for the British manufacturers, the machines appeared much more predictable and controllable than the workers. And the owners therefore dreamt of totally controlled work environments. And if and when workers were needed at all, they ought to be occupied with prescribed tasks, controllable, paced, and directed by machines. And in many ways, the industrial planning, the layout of the time, was very much more planning against undesirable or unpredictable interventions than it was planning for greater output or more predictable profits. And so the resistance of the workers at the time to the mechanization and to machines introduced into the process of their own work must be seen, as commentators like David Noble, E.P. Thompson saw, in terms of clearly understood threat to workers' control and autonomy. It was not resistance to technology per se, but it was the opposition to the division of labor and the loss of control that motivated the workers' resistance. There have been quite interesting studies on the inventions made by the very people who resisted the introduction of the machinery. These were not people who did not see the potential of innovation. It's a question who controlled the innovation, so that the people who are normally labeled Luddites understood quite well the distinction between work-related and control-related technologies that I introduced in the first lecture. Because already by the end of the 17th century, there had been a good deal of interest in the division of labor in Britain. In 1680, Sir William Petty, in a report related to the growth of the city of London, writes in favor of the division of labor as follows. In the making of a watch, if one man shall make the wheels, another the spring, another man engraves the dial plate, and another still shall make the case, then the watch will be better and cheaper than if the whole work be put upon one man. And it was that division of labor, with the lack of skill, with the lack of autonomy, with the lack of control, that people so feared. And one would say probably they had good reason. But the practical incorporation of this required a level of scale, both of factory, capital, etc., that took about 100 years. And only after about 100 years after Patty wrote that passage, the mills of England, the weaving shops, as well as the heavy industry, began to use machinery and the division of labor on an industrial scale. The steam engine at that time offered the possibility of running much larger installation. And so around 1820, the workers really knew that things were drastically different. And parliamentary and political discussion arose as to whether it was morally right, in the name of trade, prosperity, and efficiency, to introduce a mode of work that so drastically changed the working life of so many people, because so many of them indeed lost their work. And it is this angle of the machinery question that the young British historian Maxine Burke documents in a book that she also called The Machinery Question. And that book was published in 1981, and I warmly recommend it. She has, in that, reminds us that there was a very great recognition of the human costs of mechanization and the machine-dictated division of labor. Lord Byron, for instance, gave a fiery speech in Parliament, or in the House of Lords, on behalf of the weavers. And there were very interesting proposals for alternatives. People, it was not a situation, machines or no machines, but there were a number of really interesting sets of alternatives proposed at that time. One set linked to the name of Robert Owen, who very much tried to separate industrialization, which he thought was necessary and desirable, from capital accumulation and what was later became capitalism, which he could do without. And Robert Owen tried to address the question of control and management by organizational innovations, many of them sounding quite familiar to us. He developed schemes for profit sharing and sharing of controls among workers. He developed cooperative labor practices related to the division of labor that were not coupled with de-skilling that the workers so feared. Many of Owen's arguments indeed resonate to our time, and it's interesting to see the richness of that debate. There is another communality between the time of the Industrial Revolution and our time, and that is the exaggerated, really highly exaggerated hopes and ideas of the beneficial effects of technology that the proponents of the new technologies voiced. Machines and today electronic devices were soon to overcome the physical and mental shortcomings of mere humans. Machines, to the Victorians, after all, didn't drink. They didn't require the moral guidance of the kind that the Victorians lavished on the working class. Today, the banking machines don't have a union and they don't need maternity leave. Although one must say that computers do catch the most amazing viruses, but still, the banking machine doesn't need maternity leave. But when you read what the machines were going to do for the moral and human betterment and how much superior they were to mere people, you do feel on occasion, there go the expert systems, there go the great hope that the computer may know more than Socrates. And both were, I think, somewhat exaggerated. There are still a lot of things that those two times have in common, and I will not go into more of the matters of the mindset of this, because I now really want to talk about physical and administrative infrastructures. Because the one thing that has changed so dramatically at that time is the relationship between the state and industry, between the state and technology. Because these changes were catalyzed by the need for large public infrastructures in order to develop and sustain the industrial enterprises. Since the time of the Industrial Revolution, the growth and development of technology has required, and I use the word required quite advisedly, it has required the presence of infrastructures and a support relationship between technology, public institutions, and the government that did not exist before. And here we want to look at the technologies of transportation and of distribution to move new materials, finished products along road and water, rail, and later air, but also the transportation of energy and information from points of their generation to points of their use. And the distribution system and their technology links the so-called public spheres with the private spheres of industry and commerce. And the production technologies require transportation structures and distribution structures in the public sphere of all countries have provided these and adjusted themselves accordingly. Since the Industrial Revolution, providing such infrastructures had become a normal and legitimate task of government. And the distribution and the structures for the distribution of electricity may serve as an illustration, because as a commodity, electricity cannot be stored. It can't be piled up like coal and coke. So in order both to have electricity for industrial processes, but also to use the products that require electricity for their operation, the distribution networks have to be there. It's no use to have a toaster when you have nothing to plug it in. And the planning to provide for industry these structures was part of the link between the growth of industry and the task of the state. And these were very generally considered as public activities. Now think of Ontario Hydro. For instance, Sir Adam Back made a strong point saying that it was a major obligation of the government of Ontario to provide cheap electricity, as he said, for all its citizens. But primarily it was a means for attracting industry, providing incentives to develop technology, particularly the chemical industry around Niagara Falls. And Ontario Hydro's subsequent role in the development of materials and components for nuclear reactors is a direct descendant of that commitment to industrial infrastructures financed at public expense. And it started at the Industrial Revolution. And technology and the state became interlinked in a way in which they never were before. Things really took a quantum jump. It meant also that many political decisions appeared in a technical framework and in a technical garment. Some of you will remember that Ontario Hydro, for instance, used to operate on 25 cycles, when all of Europe operated on 50 and the United States on 60. This was a device to keep competition out. And within most of our lifetime, a changeover was made, although North America still works on 110 volts and 60 cycle, whereas most of the rest of the world works on 220 and 50 cycles. But these are political decisions in the garment of technical decisions. And of course, today there's a great big fight about standards on the high-resolution television, which again our political market decision under a technical garment. One of the reasons why I emphasize that relationship so much is that some of these decisions that are political ought to be political in the sense of public input and public debate. Now, as an illustration, the taxpayers of Canada have never had a chance to decide or even debate whether they wish quite substantial amounts of their tax money to be used for the development of nuclear reactors. There was never a bill before Parliament that says, is that what we ought to do? Let's discuss it, let's take a position, let's vote. Nevertheless, without the publicly funded research and development, without the industrial support, without the promotion and government loan to purchases, Canadian nuclear technology would not exist. This is a vital question, totally discussed outside a public framework because it is put into a technical language. But I think one can put it into somewhat more general terms, which I would now like to do, because I want to distinguish between divisible and indivisible benefits and divisible and indivisible costs. Now, that sounds quite academic, but in fact, it isn't so. If you were, for instance, if you had a garden and your friends helped you to tend to it and you get a colossal tomato crop, you can divide it among all those who helped you. You got a divisible benefit and the authority to distribute it. But if you and your friends got concerned about pollution and you get going and you begin to see that you ought to do something about the battery recycling plant down the street, if you, after a lot of work, succeed that they have better practices, this is an indivisible benefit. Those who helped you will get the benefit, but those who didn't and went to the movies or looked after their investments also did get the benefit. And I think that normally we think that governments whom we support through our tax structure are indeed the ones who are charged with guarding those indivisible benefits from justice and peace to clean air, drinkable water, sanitation, safe roads, access to education. The public infrastructures that made the development of technology possible have, however, more and more frequently become roads for divisible benefits. And the other side of that coin is that the same governments who produce these infrastructures have been very much less vigilant about the indivisible benefits. I would say that if we are faced today, as we are, with a global deterioration of the environment, then this could not have happened had there not been infrastructures on behalf of technology and its divisible benefits and the corresponding eclipsing of the government's obligation to safeguard and protect the sources of indivisible benefits. And whether or not it is possible to reverse the deterioration that we see will largely depend on an understanding of the obligations of government to guard those indivisible benefits that have been given away through the promotion of those infrastructures. And the strength the deep-rootedness and often the lack of visibility of those supporting infrastructures in the real world of technology are probably some form of explanation why it is so hard for individuals, for citizens, to work for the restoration of the environment or to work for peace, because one works for indivisible benefits in the light of a society that is constantly structured to promote divisible benefits. I had stressed that political decisions are often made in the guise of planning technological institutions or structures, and very often the hidden political agenda becomes visible only much later. And I want to just give you one example, and that concerns Robert Moses, the man who was instrumental in the planning of much of the facilities of New York State's public works in the period of 1930 to the late 1960s. Moses' biographer, Robert Carroll, refers to his work on the famed New York parkways, and particularly to the bridges and underpasses. These are quite low, intentionally specified by Robert Moses as that. They let private cars go past, but they do not allow buses. And so those who travel by bus because they are poor or black or both are by a mere technical device, and I say mere in quotation marks, excluded from the use of public amenities. Now, even in Robert Moses' circles, it would have been politically suicide to say we don't want them blacks in our parks. But it seemed to be perfectly acceptable to build overpasses and bridges that if they let blacks through, then at least it would be the affluent ones who in 1930, 40, 50 would drive on a public road a private car. And that is technologically packaged bias, and I will come back in one of the later lectures on the gender packaging of bias that is very similar. I would think that finally I would like to look in terms of the real world of technology into the relationship between tool and task. Because there's always a relationship between what you want to do and what you have to do it. The technological order provides a very wide spectrum of particular tools, be these organizational, be they administrative, or be they merely mechanical or electrical. But tasks tend to be structured often by the newest available tool. And it then looks as if the new tool is not only the best tool, but very often the only tool. And we know it in our own lives in small things. If you get a new kitchen appliance, you begin to slice and dice and beat them ways you've never done before. And you begin to forget that there are other ways to prepare a meal, and eventually you never do it. And by the same token, if your lab gets an electron microscope, it's amazing how many problems have to be looked at the highest possible magnification. And you find great difficulty, and I find great difficulty, to persuade students to look at anything under an optical microscope or, heaven forbid, on a magnifying glass. So the tool structures the response. And there can be a real tyranny of tools. And one has to be quite mindful of that. But I want to give you an example of how a tool can really redefine a problem. And here I want to look at speeding and radar traps, as I promised. Let's look back at the purpose of speed limits. It was to enhance safety, not to reduce criminality, that people put speed limits on major highways. And one way of enforcing these was to use the judicious presence of clearly marked police cars on the highway. They would travel at the speed limit and keep the traffic within the regulated pattern. And it was a whole traffic pattern. Then the availability of radar traps changed the situation because another factor entered to that. The emphasis now shifted from common safety to individual criminality. And the rationale was that the fear of being caught and fined would be a way to enforce the regulations. Now, you know what then happened. The next thing was a technological device that allowed the driver, safe or not, to be warned of the radar trap, the thing that's normally called a fuzzbuster. And now the motorist, less concerned with safety than with criminality, could buy an avoidance device, whether it was legal or not. The next iteration is a device for the law enforcement to detect the fuzzbuster. And there's now on the market a device in which the driver can detect the device that detects the fuzzbuster that detects the radar trap. But what it means is that the common problem of road safety has been totally transformed into a private problem and into a technological cat and mouse game. And one might say that the technological possibility of establishing random criminality have prevented the development of techniques to establish collectively a safe driving environment. And I want to close with that because that should say that one needs to look at technology, not only what it does, but also in terms of what it prevents, and whether by the mere presence of a technological approach to a social problem, one does not redefine the problem to the detriment of the total situation.
Tonight on Ideas, you've heard the second of the 1989 Massey Lectures by Ursula Franklin. This series, called The Real World of Technology, continues tomorrow. The lectures will be repeated at the end of March on Ideas, and at that time an expanded version will be available as a book published by the CBC in conjunction with the University of Toronto Press. Tonight's broadcast was produced by Max Allen with Bernie Lucht, Lorne Tulk, and Gail Brownell. I'm Mr. Sinclair.